Now there's a very lengthy medrash that describes the events that took place. It says, Haman said to Achashverosh that their God hates immorality. So what you have to do is get harlots and make a party that they'll get drunk and they'll sin and they'll do whatever they wish. And when God will see this, he will just turn away from the Jewish people. So Mordechai put out a call, don't go to eat in this Suda, because the whole purpose of this is to make you sin, and that'll bring about... So they didn't listen, and they went to the Mishkan. So nobody listened to Mordechai. So Bishmoel said there were 18,500 people who went to this party. And they ate, and they drank, and they became drunk, and they were involved in orgies like the others. The Jews had committed numerous sins. They originally bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol. Now that there may have been an excuse for, because they were, you know, there's a question of how they bowed down, they were forced and so on. But they also enjoyed themselves at Achashverosh's non-kosher feast. Although they had been exiled from the land because of the sins, they were going more and more. You know, I mean, they were enjoying themselves, going to church with everybody else, and then enjoying the repast that Achashverosh made. So the Satan immediately rose up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he said, how long will you keep such a nation that they turn away from your belief and from your morals? If you, why don't you want, he says, to destroy them? Because there's no way that they're going to do tshuva. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to the Satan, fine, bring me a Megillah, and I'll write on this Megillah their end of their destruction. So that means a decree that they will be destroyed. So that time the Satan went and he brought a Megillah, and he wrote on it. So the Torah like went out with wearing garments of mourning, and it started crying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Malachi Ashores started crying. And they said, if there won't be any Jews in this world, so why will we need a world for? What good is the world if there won't be Israelim? So then that's what the prophet says in Yeshaya when he says, Hein Erelim Tzorachu Chutza and Malachi Shalom Mar Yifkoyim. Meaning the heavenly bodies screamed out publicly, and the angels of mercy cried bitterly. So when they heard stars, and when the sun and the moon heard that, so they like took back their shine, their light. Again, the pasuk in Yeshaya where it says, Albish Shamayim Kederes, I will clothe the heavens with cloud, Vishap Osim Ksusom, and I will clothe them with rain cloth, with sackcloth as their garments. Then Eliyahu got involved. Now Eliyahu, Zohar Latov, was a very important, significant part of this Megillah, which I want to tell you shortly about him. Eliyahu ran at that time to the fathers, to Moshe, and he said to Moshe, Ad Mosai Oves Oelam Gedumi Mishina, how long are you, our fathers, going to remain sleeping? Don't you see the tzoris, the danger for Klal Yisrael? The sun, the stars, and everybody else intervening, and you're standing silently aside. So they asked him, well, why did this decree, why did this happen? So he said, because they had pleasure from the Suda of Achashverosh, and therefore they behaved in such a way that this evil decree came out. So Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov said, if they transgressed that, so what could we possibly do? So the Yahu turned back to said to Moshe, he says, you are the true shepherd of Israel. How many times did you stand up for them and be able to petition Hashem for forgiveness for the many decrees? And quoting a pasuk from Tehillim where it says, if not for Moshe the Chosen, standing up in the breach in order to turn back the wrath, what would have been against the Bnei Yisrael? So why are you staying here, they told Moshe. So Moshe said, is there one good person in this generation that it's worth intervening for? So he answers him, yes, and his name is Mordechai. So he says, go tell Mordechai what is happening, Moshe said. Say, Eliyahu, because we know there's such a thing as Gilo Eliyahu, go tell Mordechai what is happening in order that he should immediately start praying, and we will ask for Rachamim from HaKadosh Baruch Hu here. Now this is before the events happened. This is right after the period that they went to the Sudas Achashverosh. So then he said, but what do you mean you'll ask for Rachamim, they told Moshe. But it already had been signed, the document of destruction, the decree. So Moshe asked, and he said the following, was it signed with teat, meaning like with mud, dirt? So he said, If it's with teeth, there's such a thing that you can still pray. If it was signed in blood, you can't do anything. So he answered him, it was signed betit, with this mud. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, fine, go and tell Mordechai what happened. So that's what the pasuk means, Mordechai yoda es kol asher nase. What does this mean? Mordechai already knew. Later it says, when the decree came out, Mordechai knew what happened. So it means Mordechai yoda, he had known all the way before. And he had been praying even before by himself, because there was a Gilu Eliyahu, because Eliyahu, after he came from Moshe Rabbeinu, so Eliyahu came to Mordechai. Now it's also interesting, by the Gam Charvona, you know, afterwards we say, after the Megillah, we sing the Bracha, and we say there, Or Haman, Boruch Mordechai. And we also say, in addition to cursed be Haman and blessed Mordechai, we say, V'gam Charvona Zachar Letov. Charvona should also be remembered, Letov, to be blessed. Now, who is this Charvona? Now, it's mentioned, Charvona, in chapter 7, you'll see verse 9. There, when it's speaking about the imminent destruction of Haman, it says there, V'yomer Charvona, Echad Minas Arisim, that Charvona was one of the chamberlains, Lifnei HaMelech, said to the king, here is the eighth, this is present, we have here the tree that Haman had made to hang Mordechai on this tree. So what happened? We know the story was. So Vayomer HaMelech, Talu Elov, the king said, hang him there. So they hung Haman on the tree. Now Charvona here, this is the Charvona. So when we sing in the Megillah afterwards, V'gam Charvona, and also Charvona, Zocher Letov, should be remembered for his presence, or for what he did. Now the question is, what does it mean, remember Charvona? If he did a good thing, so Charvona should be blessed. If he was it was against the Jews, he should be cursed. What is the idea of he should be remembered Letov? He deserves a blessing. So they bring down an interesting interpretation from the Dubna Magid. The Dubna Magid gave the following interpretation. There is a Medrash on this passage, and the Medrash says, Vayomer Charvona. Charvona said, so it says, at that time, Eliyahu Anovi came. The spirit of Eliyahu infiltrated the body of Charvona. And it came out that Eliyahu was the one who did the talking. It wasn't Charvona, but it was Eliyahu who told Haman about the eights. But Eliyahu was garbed and involved in the body of Charvona. So therefore, Charvona didn't do anything. So why should he get a bracha for it? It was really Eliyahu. But you still have to mention him in a positive sense, because why did Eliyahu pick Charvona? Why didn't he pick somebody else to enter and to come up with this? So you must say that Charvona had at least a little bit good in him. So therefore Eliyahu picked him, and there's the klal of Megalgalin Sklus HaYidei Zakai, that if you have to bring and do a merit-worthy act, you always take the one who has some merit for him. So therefore, he says, for example, you could compare it, the Dubna Magid says, to a person who's going for his son's wedding and he doesn't have any garments, proper garments, so he borrows a coat from somebody else. When he comes back to the from the wedding, he gives the friend back the coat, and he also gives him back certain present. He brought him some cake from desserts, from the dessert of the wedding, as a present. So the same idea here is, Eliyahu borrowed his coat, in a sense, so he has to give him, so we give him back a little bit, we throw something his way. So we see that Eliyahu was involved very much in this entire period. Now, Eliyahu Malach HaShalom, Eliyahu is the one who, this is the idea, that really Eliyahu is used by Hashem, Gilu Eliyahu, for his revelation. He participates for the benefit of Klal Yisrael throughout the ages. This is the great Maile of Eliyahu. So I'm referring back to this Medrash, that Eliyahu was a very involved person concerning the events that happened during that period. And I will continue.
Lo al HaMelech, then later on, it says, it's a difficult question. First, I see the Gra gives a good answer. It always bothers me. If you notice, when Haman tells the king in verse 16. In chapter 1, verse 16, it says, Vayomer Memuchan. Memuchan said, now we know that Memuchan is Haman. And why was he called Memuchan? Because Muchan means he is prepared for destruction, meaning his destiny is bad. Alright? So Memuchan said, Memuchan, it was Haman. Aside, the Gemara also makes note on this, that Memuchan was the smallest of the advisors, the youngest and not the greatest, wisest. So he was the one that spoke up. So Hannah said, from here we see that it's always an ignoramus who thrusts himself to the forefront. Meaning, when a king has a number of advisors, the advisor who is a little more astute and perhaps a little more insight, he isn't the one to shoot right out and to give advice. But it's always the one that's missing a little sable. So it says, or that lacks a little perspicacity, he doesn't know the whole situation to look at. So it says, Vayemer Memuchan lifnei hamelech. Memuchan answered. But what was his answer? He said, not only did Vashti rebel against the king, but she also rebelled al kol asorim, right? Not only did she go ahead and cause this rebellion, but all the ministers and all the nation, when they'll hear what happened to Vashti, so they will have contempt for the husbands and so on. So in a sense, Vashti destroyed the entire kingdom. Not only did she rebel against you. So now the Gra asks, really, it should be the other way around. I mean, if you're speaking to a king, what is the greatest sin? That you're rebelling against the king, that his wife rebelled against him. So he should have first said, not only against you, but also on everybody else. It should have said, not only about everybody else, but against you she rebelled. I mean, the emphasis should have been that the rebellion was really primarily against him. What do the other people matter? He is the king, and his wife rebelled against him. So what is the, not only against you, but against everybody. I mean, kind of the language is that. So the Gra says the following. He wanted the king, what he was leading for here, was that they should go ahead and write out a judgment that Vashti should be put to death. Now normally, the king used to be a judge. But the king, it's not right for the king really to judge when an affront was done against him. So therefore, he would perhaps ask his advice what to do, because it's not proper to judge when it involves him directly. So what Memuchan said, Lo al ha-melech levado. That's true, it involves you directly and you don't want to judge. But it also involves everybody else in the kingdom. Therefore, it's your obligation to judge it. So he wanted the king immediately to go ahead and to give out a resolution against Vashti, she should be put to death. So that's how the Gra explains the language here. The biggest threat, of course, was for the king, but he emphasized the idea that you judge against everybody else in order that he should respond and give a punishment. The passage in 120 reads that, let us send out a statement throughout the kingdom and let the verdict of the king be passed out and distributed to Homa-Huso and his great kingdom, and all the women will give honor to their husbands, so that means to be the edict, that the women should give honor to their husbands. So now all of a sudden the edict that was sent out, they had big problems at that time, because the people came from so many different countries, and they had so many different languages. So who would be the nusach that you would follow in the house? We even know by us, for example, if a Sephardi marries an Ashkenazi, so you always go with the husband's custom. This, of course, in those days was almost axiomatic. It was no question about it. So all of a sudden, Achashverosh uncovered a new idea. So they'll say, something must be going on there. He doesn't make sense. People started to question, what does Achashverosh mean when he sends out these edicts? Whenever we get another decree from him, we better really investigate what it's all about. So therefore, when he said there's one nation that should be punished, they would have taken him seriously, they wouldn't have waited, and they would have gone ahead and immediately wreaked havoc and destroyed Klal Yisrael. So in a sense, this was also from God. It was a hidden miracle. But Hashem made this in order that people shouldn't take the king's statement at face value. And in that way, the Purim story was able to present itself.
Now, let's take a look at a few points in chapter 2. where it says, Vayomru, this is after the king had given over the decree. The king had given over his decree, and then he felt morose. Once he woke up from his drunken slumber, so he didn't, he woke up and he was very disturbed. So it said, Yomru Narei HaMelech Meshor Sof, the servants of the king said, let's go and search out for the king, Naros Psuvos Tovos Mare, a beautiful young maiden. So now, really, they point out that the entire event that occurred here in choosing a maiden, through verse 4, where it says, Danara Shertita Veine Amela Tinloch Tachas Vashti, the girl who the king finds favor, she will be queen instead of Vashti, and the king agreed. So they point out here that this whole thing, the Gemara says, was really miraculous, because who were the ones that gave the advice to the king? Normally you would think that the one that the king would turn to for advice would be the seven advisors of chapter 1. All of a sudden here we don't see about them at all. The king listens to the advice of the Ne'orim, all right? The Ne'orim, meaning his chamberlains, the butlers, the one who serve him, not his true advisors. And when Muhan in the previous chapter said, let the king give the throne to a peer, Hatova Mimenu, Lira'usa. Lira'usa would mean to another royal person who is from a royal family, because really it was Vashti Amalka. That's what really angered the king, because she always lorded it to him that she was from royalty and he was a commoner. So over here, they insisted that, of course, it's only proper for the king to bring in a different royal person in order to marry. But when he's speaking, that's what the advisor said. But over here, he's speaking the Narei HaMelech, they forget all about royalty. What did they emphasize? Tevas Mare. Yevakshu LaMelech Naras Psulos Tevas Mare. Forget the genealogy, forget the yichas. The ikar is they should be tevas mare, they should be fair of appearance. And they said here also, timloch tachas Vashti. They didn't say in place of the Malka Vashti, but in place of Vashti. Not even Vashti Amalka. So the Gra points out that in this event, the way they proceeded to present to the king, that itself showed that it's, you know, that it's not b'derech hateve, because this is not the way that it should have happened. Because if he would have listened to the Yoatzim, so Esther would have not had a chance. Because why? Because ain Esther Magedes Moladata. Esther wouldn't mention where she's from. So all they know, she could be from a lost child who has, whose parents are who knows what, and they just foundling that was thrown away. So she had no chance to become queen. But it had to be that she should be queen. So therefore, it was taken away from the power of the Yoatzim, and it was given over to the lads who forgot all about the Yichus, and they said that let's concentrate on the beauty. And it so happened that Esther was this fair, and she was taken.
The law also says that they gathered the women together from all the countries. Why did they pick Esther? Because it says, Nari Yifas Toar Tovas Mare. She was extremely beautiful, and they brought her to the house of the king. So it seems that he, the most beautiful one in the kingdom, we would assume. But then we'll get back to that point. But then what does it say? Esther came to the king, and it says that Esther did not request anything, but whatever they gave her. So the Gra says that if you look at the Tamim, at the Trop, now, on top of the word Nara v'Nara, you'll find the trop in sentence 12, Kadmo ve'azlo, ubagia ter Nara v'Nara, Nara v'Nara. In Aramaic, again, Nara v'Nara means Kadmo ve'azlo. Kadmo ve'azlo means Kadmo, to get up, ve'azlo, and to go. It means to go with enthusiasm, kadmo ve'azlo. When it comes to Esther, it says, v'hagia tor Esther. When Esther's turn came. What does it mean when Esther's turn came? So the negina on that word is munach munach. V'hagia tor Esther. Munach munach means slowly, slowly. So the Gros said, from here we see the difference from Esther to the others. They wanted to be chosen. So by them it was Katmah Ve'Azla. They went on their own initiative. When it came to Esther, it was Munach, Munach. In a sense, the way Esther was really dragged along. She didn't want to be chosen, that she would run after. The same thing, the Gros, you know, there's a famous Gemara. The Gemara in Megillah says, discusses Esther. So there is one interpretation that said that Esther was a Yerakrakis. Yerakrakis means she was like a Hadassah. A Hadass is green. So she had a green complexion. So she had a green complexion. Why was she chosen? Because a Chut Shel Chesed, we don't pop the old little girls want to be Queen Esther, but according to this interpretation, it said that there was a grace, Chut Shel Chesed, Moshe Chaleo. There was like a halo of divine grace resting over her head. And that's why she was chosen. So the question is, why should he go ahead and come and shatter the myth, in a sense, to take out the literal interpretation? It says, Va'anara, in verse 7, it said, Va'anara tovas yifas toar v'tovas mare, that she was very beautiful of form. So why does he go ahead, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korfa, and make her into a green complexion with God's grace? Rather, it said she was beautiful of form. So he said, very interesting interpretation that only God said. We find another Gemara in Baba Basra. There was an argument there in Tezvot, when did Eve live? So there are many opinions as to what period Eve lived. One opinion was that Eve was never lived, but it was like an example. But others, one opinion is, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, the one who said this, said that Eve lived in the days of Ahasuerus. So what does that have to do? So the Gros says, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, who said that she was green, said also that Eve lived in the days of Ahasuerus. And if you look in the book of Eve, it says, V'lo nimsa noshim yofos kibnos Eve b'chol ha'or. Eve's daughters were the most beautiful women in the entire land, meaning in the entire empire of Ahasuerus. So if they were the most beautiful, and they lived in the times of Ahasuerus, so they had to be more beautiful than Esther, because it says they were the most beautiful in the entire land. So they had to be more beautiful than Esther. So therefore, he says that really Esther wasn't that beautiful. Yerakrakis, and that's perhaps why they called her Hadassah, because she didn't compare like to the daughters of Eve. But there was a chut shel chesed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put over, that it was Neser Chaim.
Now, she, we know, was adopted by Mordecai. Some say he married her, some say he didn't, but he was just adopted her as a child. She was his family. But how is Mordecai described in verse 5? It says, an Ish Yehudi hoya b'shushan abira, ushmei Mordecai ben Yair ben Kish Ish Yemini Asher Hagwa, who went into Galus, etc. But the genealogy is described Mordecai ben Yair ben Kish. So the Chazal tell us that each one of these descriptions of the names has also a second connotation. The word Ben Yair means he enlightened the eyes of the Jews with his prayers. Mordecai, it seems, was outstanding in his prayers. That's why we said earlier with Eliyahu HaNavi that Mordecai should pray. Shimi, Ben Shimi, that God heard his tefillah, the prayers of Mordecai. Ben Kish, that he knocked on the doors of Rachamim, of mercy. So all of this was alluded. A lot of times the name of an individual depicts or connotes what type of an individual it is. By Mordecai, it wasn't Mordecai so much, but his old background, three generations. Ben Yair, meaning that his prayers were strong enough to enlighten the Jews. Ben Shimi, that God responded by listening. Ben Kish, like he knocked on the doors of Rachamim, of mercy. So the Gros said that a person has really four senses. There is Ria, seeing, Shmia, hearing, Dibur, well, it's touching, but without that, Reach, smelling, and Dibur, speaking. He says, three of them are necessary for Talmud Torah. What three? To study anything. Ria, you have to be able to see what's written in the Torah. Shmia, you have to be able to hear. Torah Shabbat Peh, that is being taught. Dibur, you have to go ahead and talk to teach others. But Reach, he says, fragrance has really nothing to do with Torah, but it does have to do with the tefillah, with worship. Why? Because when we say our prayers are accepted in place of our sacrifices, which is described the sacrifice as Reach Nicheach Lashem, as a pleasant fragrance unto God. So that has to do with tefillah. Now we spoke about the other three, but the name Mordecai. Mordecai, he says, where does the word Mordecai come from? So the Chazal, the Gemara, tells us that in a pasuk in the Torah, there is an allusion to Mordecai. Where does the Torah come to Mordecai? So it says, Kach lecha b'somim mor dror. Take the psalmim, the incense, when it speaks about the incense that is used in the altar, so it says, take the incense that is made out of mor dror. And the targum of mor dror is morei dachya. Morei dachya means the top of all the psalmim. So it comes out that that is the best fragrance from Mordecai. And since fragrance has to do with tefillah, with prayer, so therefore, we say Mordecai had all four bechinos b'tefillah, meaning not only, like we say, Mordecai means tefillah himself, his own prayer. Ben Yair, meaning, so that would be from fragrance. Ben Yair would mean from seeing. Ben Kish, from what? From, Kish would be Shehikish al Dibor. And Ben Shimi, from listening. So four aspects of the person, four chushim of the person, all possessed by Mordecai, were concentrated in tefillah. And this is the emphasis on the tefillah of Mordecai. Now Mordecai was exiled in verse 6 from Yerushalayim. So it says three times the word gola, exiled. So the Vilna Gaon says that Mordecai could not part from Yerushalayim. So he would escape back to Eretz Yisrael, and then he would be exiled again. So there were three times that he came back from Eretz Yisrael, and went back, and they still exiled him, but he would come back and run. Now, in verse 10, it says there that when Esther was chosen, Lehigida Esmo Ladato, still in this chapter 2, verse 10, that Esther refused to tell her background. Why did she tell her background? Because Mordecai told her, Asher lo tagi. Mordecai was afraid that if they go ahead and tell her the background, so they will take revenge because she refused really to come to the king. They had to bring her forcibly, and therefore they would take revenge on her if they found out indeed that she's a Jewish girl. Now that Esther saw that they were treating her with such honor, and they weren't angry at her, so she would think that Mordecai's concern is no longer a concern. Originally, when they had a schlepper, so he was afraid if she'll say who she is and where she is, they'll go ahead like we know how they behave now, they'll just kill out everybody. But now she sees at this point that they're treating her with silk gloves, and all of this, the concern is no longer a concern, so why shouldn't she go ahead and tell her background? So therefore, the pasuk emphasizes, why didn't she tell her background? Although the reason that she believed originally Mordecai meant was no longer relevant, yet the fact that Mordecai told her, she had absolute trust in Mordecai, and she refused.
In chapter 2, it reads there, by Yomi Mohen, in those days Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, big son was Seresh, Shnei Sarise. Now, note here. Here it doesn't say Bikson Voseresh. Here it says Biksono with an aleph. So what happened to the aleph? Why in chapter 2 it's called Bikson Voseresh? And here it's Biksono Voseresh. What is the aleph? So a famous interpretation is given from a number of commentaries. The Alshich and a number of people say it. It says the following. The Chazal say that Haman had sons who were the scribes of the king. They were the Sofrei HaMelech. So when it came to write in the chronicles of the king, what occurred, which they used to keep like a diary, you know, king's papers, chronicles. So what happened, so they wrote the following. They wrote, Higid Mordechai, Al Bikson, O Seresh. They put in an O. What does that mean? In chapter 2, they had written, there you see the words Bikson, O Seresh. But originally when they wrote it Bikson, O Seresh. Aleph Vav is a word of its own. Bikson without the Aleph Viseresh would mean Bikson and Seresh, two people, two accomplices. Bikson, O Seresh, with either one. According to that, if the king would see either one, so he would say, you know, what kind of man is this Mordechai? He had two people killed because he wasn't sure. I had to kill both. I had to kill one innocent person because one was a plotter, but he didn't know which one it was. So, I mean, that's not such a fine thing that Mordechai should have been a little more astute and to realize which one of the two, not say they all sound the same, but say which one of the two did the killing. So that was their intent. They went ahead and they wrote, Bikson, O Seresh. And therefore, not only doesn't he deserve a compensation, but we really should punish him for not knowing who it is and bringing about the death of an enemy. But in Esav, what happened with the mess? The word O separated. The Aleph went to Bikson, and the Vav went to Seresh. So therefore, it wasn't Bikson O Seresh, it was Bikson O Seresh. And in that way, it seems that there were two people that were plotting, and Mordechai caught both of these people. So therefore, Mordechai is worthy, that this is an answer that they gave. That's why we find, instead of the Aleph, originally there was no Aleph, there was O, and the O was separated. Now, Esther told also to the king, and it says, Atan Esther Hamalka. Esther Hamalka said, the king asked her, what do you desire? What do you want? So it says there that Esther Hamalka answered, if the king agrees, that's the way they used to address the king. Tinosin li, grant me nafshi, my life, b'shelosi, ve'ami, and my people, b'vakoshosi, as my petition. So, B'edis and Einish, it says the difference from a she'ela to a bakosha. It's like a dual phrase. She'elosi, my question, my desire, bakoshosi, my request. What is the difference from she'ela to bakosha? He says she'ela is something which is for a small time, lizman, a small period of time. Bakosha is constant, extended, it's immediate, forever. So she was saying the following, Tinosin li nafshi b'shelosi, because a person is mortal, so how long does a person have to live? But b'shelosi, my request is, for that period that I have to live, you should grant me life. But ve'ami, not to destroy my nation, because bivakoshosi, that is a continuous request. Because if chas v'sholem he destroys the people, that eternally there won't be a Jewish nation. That's why when she asks for the people, she uses the word bakoshosi, which means this will be a answer or a response which will be forever. Whereas when she says, grant me life, it's only b'shelosi, in a sense, it's only for a terminal period, for a set short period of time. That's why she specifically chose the words she'elosi and bakoshosi. Mordechai wrote the Megillah in the present form, and Esther requested of the Chazal, of the sages of her day, to commemorate for all generations by going ahead and incorporating it. But it was written either by Mordechai or Esther. They had a very important part in it. Some of the commentaries say that this book was really part of the chronicles of the kings of Persia, Horus and Madai, and Esther requested for them to take the story from the miracle of Purim, that story from those books, and to put it in a separate sefer. Now, the Gemara does say was written with Ruach HaKadosh. There was divine Ruach HaKadosh intervention. How to know how to write it? And what is of interest is how did they prove that there was Ruach HaKadosh by the author? That the author that wrote it, he wasn't the prophet. It wasn't through prophecy. So how did they know that it was Ruach HaKadosh? So the sages in the Talmud quote certain verses
from the scriptural, from this passages, and they say from there we see it was Ruach HaKodesh. Now it's of interest, which verses do they quote? So in chapter 6, verse 6, it said, Haman said to himself. Now how could the writer possibly know what Haman said to himself, that he said anything to himself? Obviously, you didn't hear. Yet when you look in chapter 6, verse 6, the words read there, just to quote, Vayomer Haman Belibo. It says there that Haman came into the king, and the king said to him, what should we do for a person who I wish to favor? So it said, Haman said to himself. Now how was the author of this book supposed to know what Haman said to himself? So obviously, God let him know. In a sense, he told him, Mordechai, who had Ruach HaKodesh, to realize that what Haman said to himself. Then also, Rebbe Akiva comes along, and where it says in chapter 2, verse 15, it speaks there of Esther. When Esther's turn came, she didn't ask for anything except what they gave her, the cosmetics that she was supposed to use, but she didn't request any special favors. And then it says, and Esther found favor in the eyes of all those who saw her. How do we know if Esther found favor in the eyes of all those who saw her? Nobody went taking a census or an immediate poll to see if everybody liked Esther. So obviously it had to be because the writer, whoever authored this in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah or Mordechai, had Ruach HaKodesh. Now Reb Meir says, we know from a third passage, because it says in 2:22, it said that this matter that they sought to assassinate Achashverosh became known to Mordechai, and Mordechai told Esther Hamalka. So now it said the matter became known to Mordechai, meaning that he became aware of the plot to assassinate the king. How else did he become aware of it? So he says, well, the obvious way was through the divine spirit that he became aware of this plot. Reb Yossi ben Dermaxis goes ahead and he bases it on the past 9:15, where it says there that the Jews took vengeance against their enemies, but they did not take any of the spoils. How do we know, how does the writer know what happened in the far-flung provinces that nobody took any of the spoils? So it must have been through Ruach HaKodesh that he had divine spirit of God that made him know this fact. So these explanations are given by the various Tanoim. So Shmuel, who was a later scholar from the Amoraim, he says, if I would have been there, I would have given a better reason, because in chapter 9, verse 27, it says an extra word in the passage. It says, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim aleihem v'al kol ha-nilvim, the Jews, Kimu v'kiblu, they ordained and took upon themselves on the entire Jewish nation that these 2 days of Purim should be celebrated every year. So Shmuel said, what does this mean that Kimu Vekiblu? So they give a reason, all of the proofs that the earlier Tanoim brought can be refuted. For example, Rabbi Akiva's proof that he said that every person, you know, how did they know they found favor? Because it could have been that every person who saw her stated, oh, she must be from my nation. But the extra word of Kimu Vekiblu, since it was inserted Kimu Vekiblu, on that there is no question that they couldn't refute it. Now, the name of God, we find, is not listed in the Megillah. Now, there's a lot of discussion. Why didn't they list the name of God in the Megillah? So some reasons were, the Akedah Yitzchak, for example, said that since, if we say this was a copy of a non-Jewish document, so obviously the basic part of it, so obviously the name of God was not really mentioned. Another reason given is the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra gives the reason that the book was originally written by Mordechai, and it was going to be sent to the Jews of all the provinces. And it would be copied later, it was, subsequently it was copied by the Persians, and brought in to the annals of their kings. So now, lest the latter substitute the name of their pagan god for the divine name, so you tried to keep this in a secular vein, that they wouldn't see the name of God, so they wouldn't go ahead and substitute the name of God for that name. And we find this in the Ramban in a different place in Chumash. They were very concerned that when you go ahead and write miracles, where it's very obvious that God's name was involved, so the pagans had a tendency that they would go ahead and omit the name of God and put in their God in place of that. We find many places, for example, the Arabay, that there was an Akedah, but instead of bringing Yitzchak to the Akedah, it was Yishmael that was brought to the Akedah. So a lot of sources are changed, and their gods are inserted. So therefore, he left the name of God out, because this would be recognized as a great event in annals of Persian history, and therefore was omitted. But there are a number of sentences where the Kabbalists have found that the name of God is mentioned in the Megillah by using letters. For example, in verse 120, it says there that he, the Chol HaNoshim, Yitnu Yikor LeBalei, and that means let's get rid of Vashti Passanuidic, so that she and all the women will give the proper respect to their husbands. So over here, if you notice, the first letter is Hey, Vav, Hey, Yud. And if you take it backwards, it's Yud K, Vav K. Another one, you have chapter 2, verse 5. Here you also have an expression where it says, Ish Yehudi, Hoya, Bishushan Abiro. Lay Mordechai, Yehudi, Hoya. If you take the word Yehudi, Hoya, you have a Yud K, Yud K. You notice the word, the two letters of Yehudi is Yud K, and the first and the last two letters of Hoya is Yud K. So you have Yud K, Yud K. What does that mean? That means that Mordechai, Ish Yehudi Oyoshma, Mordechai was planted there by God. Now in chapter 5, verse 4, just to quote another one, it says, Yavo HaMelech VeHaman Hayom. Esther said, if the king wishes, let the king and Haman come to a party. All right, so the idea was, God put his mind to this matter, meaning that Esther came to Haman with the power of Hashem to overpower Haman and destroy him from this world. So this was Esther's idea. Yaveh HaMelech is Yud, the first letter of HaMelech, Hey, and VeHaman is Vav, and the last one is Hey. Another two places, not to go through every one, but there are really, basically, there are five places where the letter Yud-K, Vav-K is inserted. Another one in chapter 5, 13, and another one in chapter 7, verse 7. And therefore, in many congregations, the person that reads these words, he reads them quickly to show that they have some special significance. And he puts the tune there a little bit differently. So now we know that God was involved, but God was hidden in there.